Hi, my name is Dr. Lisa Belanger, and welcome back to The Science of Work, where we take a deep dive into the habits, skills, work design, and leadership behind global trends in the workforce. We talk about optimizing work design, but how exactly do you do that when you're constantly navigating uncertainties? Well, everyone keeps talking about the last couple years being uncertain, which is certainly true. This is, however, true that things will not become certain or predictable anytime soon. I hear the phrase often, we're living in unprecedented times. While I look forward to precedented times, leaning into rapid change, evolving landscapes, and agile mindset may be the most important skill set as we embrace the new world of working. So how exactly do we strategize in periods of uncertainty? This episode, I have the privilege to speak to Dr. Paul Shoemaker, who is an author, speaker, entrepreneur, and academic in the field of decision science, leadership, and strategy. He spent time at Wharton School of Business, University of Chicago, Berkeley, just to name a few. He has 12 books, contributor to the Harvard Business Review, and prestigious publications from around the world. He's also consulted in some of the world's largest and most powerful companies and governments. He's exactly who I want telling me how to strategize for myself, my career, and business looking forward. This is a much needed conversation as we stand on unstable ground. The Science of Work is brought to you by the Quantic School of Business and Technology. Quantic's highly selective online MBA and executive MBA is designed with interactive micro-lessons and individualized feedback every 8 seconds. Experience the future of education. Go to quantic.edu/scienceofwork for more. I am somebody who advocates for data-driven decision-making when at all possible. There are two types of people in the world. The people who do an aggressive amount of research before purchase or major decisions, and those that do not. I'm a researcher by trade, and I've only recently learned to leverage emotions as data and lend somewhere in between. So of course, my business, as we started 2 weeks prior to mass shutdowns caused by the pandemic, even going through a proper risk and threat assessment, we did not have global pandemic on our list of scenarios. However, we probably should have. At the very least, we should have had, what if we cannot gather? And what if we cannot gather for a very long time? We were required to pivot, embrace technology, and wait for the world to embrace technology, and then we were off to the races. From an earning potential, it actually opened up the world. Cheers to the 11 p.m. keynotes in India and 4 a.m. keynote in Croatia. And allows for several keynotes, workshops, and consulting a day, which travel would have previously limited. There's an old Indian proverb, which we'll add to the show notes, that states at the end, good thing, bad thing, don't know. We often assume change and uncertainty are bad. Often it may have negative short-term ramification, but offers opportunity if you can see it. If you come from a business background or taken business courses, you might have heard of Porter's Five Forces model or PEST analysis for strategic thinking, which takes into account political, economic, social, and technological external influences, or many of the other theories when it involves strategy. Further to these, what we're going to talk about is strategy during periods of uncertainty, which involves scenario planning or future mapping, after getting as much information from as many different sources as possible, creating flexible strategies, and then creating a system of dynamic monitoring. This conversation with Dr. Shoemaker is insightful. If this is something you would like to do for yourself, your team, or your company, be sure to check out our website, consciousworks.com, as we'll have many additional resources and the books that Dr. Shoemaker has written on this topic. So today what we're talking about is really about strategizing in ambiguity and in uncertainty and how we do this. And of course, regardless of where you're sitting, that's just been part of life for the last couple of years, if not beyond that. So what would be your first thoughts? So you're sitting in a strategic planning meeting or sitting down to start strategizing about the future. All that is appearing is question marks. What do you do?
I assume now it's in a corporate setting, not for yourself, but you can apply it to an individual, to a group, an organization, a society. I mean, some of my colleagues are working with the European Union and trying to figure out how it should reconstitute itself. So there's different levels of social aggregation in terms of who are involved. And that complicates the problem, obviously, because eventually you want to look at uncertainty to arrive at decisions or strategic moves. There is a school of thought that says, no, you don't have to make a decision necessarily. You just want to understand better what the uncertainty is about. The term scenario planning, if you ask many people, what is it? You get different answers. Some people consider it just developing narratives about the future to be better informed, to be more attuned to what's going on, to do sense-making in the present. And other people say, well, that's only the start. You do that in order to test your current strategies or to improve them and to keep and have an ongoing dialogue in the organization. So because if it's really uncertain, you probably do not want to stick out your neck 100%, but do it in stages. And that's one of the pieces of advice people suggest. Know what you don't know. Don't try to pretend you know more than you do. Recognize all the biases that human beings have, being overconfident. So if you really want to understand the external environment and the uncertainty in that environment, I think you want to recognize that you need a holistic view. You cannot just deal with one piece. So that wide angle view is hard to get your arms around. But if you use scenario planning, which many companies use, according to Bain, the consulting firm, 50% or more of the Fortune 500 companies claim they do scenario planning. But I just pointed out that the semantics of that phrase, there's no uniformity about it. I consider it both. Scenario planning is a way of developing narratives to simplify a very complex environment and tell a few archetypal stories that can typify in a way you end up. The difficulty is first to decompose this blob called uncertainty and then to put it together again in ways that you can actually test your existing strategies against it, but better yet, formulate better ones that are more robust and have more resilience in these different futures that you are imagining.
And that makes complete sense. And then you said something that's really interesting to me, where you're trying to find that wide angle view. And so even before any kind of scenario planning or strategizing, you're really looking and trying to find out what you know and what you don't know. But you also mentioned it's incredibly challenging to do, to know what you don't know, especially. But that's where you see this need for diversity and inclusion so that you can get a whole bunch of different views at the table.
Yes, from the group or maybe outside. I would say from outside that group as well. So even if you're sitting in a meeting, as you say, inside a company and as a team tasked with figuring out the uncertainty of the future, they should not assume they have all the answers there. I would start, by the way, by saying, what have we missed in the past? And what I do, if I'm in a company and we look 10 years into the future, let's say that's a long term, I want to understand four times that time frame, four decades going backwards. And I want to know in that industry, what happened? What were the causes? Were they driven by social issues, political, technological, economic, et cetera? And how much was missed by this organization or the entire industry? And even companies that are very good. I spent a long sabbatical in London at Royal Dutch Shell in the 1980s, just after OPEC had happened in 1973, oil prices had quadrupled and they quadrupled further in 1979 because of the war between Iraq and Iran. And then they dropped again below 10, et cetera. And so it's a highly volatile environment and they have to make very long-term decisions. You know, you got to live with a refinery or a concession for an oil field to develop for 30, 40, 50, 70 year of contracts. And that's why scenario planning, I think, arose in more the extractive industries, mining and oil and gas, is that you're dealing with the most difficult situation, deep uncertainty, long-term, and you have to make commitments about very specialized assets. If you guess wrong, if you build a platform in the North Sea and there's nothing there, the oil price is not helping you or the environmental regulations that you can't continue, there's nothing else you can do with the platform. I mean, it has no second use to speak of. Yeah, and Seagull Observatory, perhaps, but there isn't much. Whereas if you invest in a building, you know, okay, you build a hospital, but you make a mistake. Well, that could still become a university facility or a corporate thing. So I would start by saying how specialized are the investments you're going to make, because that tells you how much risk you're really taking. I would also not only talk about what's uncertain, but what hand of cards do we have? What are the current directions for what way we want to go? And how much flexibility can be built in those investments, right? Are they scalable? Are they decomposable? Are they reconfigurable? If you start to think in those terms, I think you can get a handle on uncertainty. I should also say, what is uncertainty? I sort of have a knowledge spectrum that starts with certainty. There are things that we know with certainty. Philosophers may doubt it, but the sun will come up tomorrow. I mean, I'm willing to bet a lot of money on that one. And you and I will die at some point and we'll pay taxes, right?
And we'll pay taxes.
The certainties in life. Then there is the risk case, which we can compute, where we have historical data, life insurance risks, et cetera. And then you have uncertainty, where you don't know the probabilities. That's at least how I would define it. But you may still know the outcomes. You know, you start a new job. Okay, you don't know the probabilities that it will go this or the other way. Ambiguity to me is that you don't even know the outcome space. That's more complicated. If you cannot even specify the things that could happen, let alone the probabilities of these outcomes happening. And then there are yet deeper cases where you don't even understand what the problem is. Climate change, for example. We don't even really understand the crux of the issue. So now you're getting into the domain of ignorance or chaos that is more difficult than ambiguity.
Right.
And the strategies may differ somewhat, but the general advice is very simple. The more you know, the more you can be analytical and optimized. And the less you know, the more your strategy should be about surfacing your collective ignorance in the group and in the company, number one, and then engage in learning exercises, getting back to your point. So at Shell, what we would do is we would interview lots of outside experts in terms of, let's say, environmental regulations. So in this team that we're hypothetically talking about in a company, it wouldn't be bad to say, first of all, are we even ready to tackle this? Do we have enough knowledge ourselves? And what could we read? And then people can come in. Because we've had clients that want to do scenario planning, and they are just not ready for it. They don't have the requisite knowledge base to even know what they don't know.
One of the videos I recently saw was really about how people respond to uncertainty. So trying to kind of quantify their agility in some way, shape, or form, they would ask founders of company startups, what if questions? So instead of saying, tell me about a time that you blah, 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 they want what ifs. What if this scenario comes up? So repeatedly doing that, is that a good practice where you're just constantly challenging yourself to the what ifs? Or is there another kind of questions you should be asking? I'm thinking of like, how do you even start, right? I agree with you being able to try to watch everything, read everything you can and get that knowledge base. But within that group, is there questions to ask? Sorry, that was a very long way to ask that question. But is there a systematic way to go about finding out what you don't know and starting off that conversation?
Yeah, but and it is about starting a conversation. If you look at it that way, there's a very good book by Kees van der Heijden, a former Shell planner. Shell became well known for this scenario planning. But it is about the art of strategic conversation. So they would say, if you could go to that crystal ball or and ask it some questions about the future, what questions would you ask? What's not interesting is what the people say, but how it starts a conversation, because then you say, why do you ask those questions? And is this aligned with the past? I still think your past tells you something of where your blind spots are. I did this at Royal Dutch Shell. Shell did not at the time miss much in terms of oil prices and economics. They were very good at tracking it. They knew as much as most, you know, government desks would, et cetera. But they were blindsided a few times in mostly things that are soft things, stuff that has to do with society and media and public reactions. I'll give you examples that they really got blindsided by for a company that is considered the paragon of how you do scenario planning. One was in Brent Spire, the North Sea. They had to get rid of a platform that was no longer productive. And the rational answer, if you did the decision trees and the simulations, was to sink it. And you get reefs. But Greenpeace, of course, and others, environmental groups, really didn't like that. Shell stuck with the rational view after the BBC was starting to criticize it. Greenpeace occupied the platform, raised their flag, forced all these executives and other people off. And they finally had to do exactly what Greenpeace wanted to do, which is to decompose the platform, take it to shore, clean it, but do it in an environmentally friendly way. We can't use the oceans as our wastebasket. You know, that was their viewpoint. So Shell got a really black eye on that one. So I think you have to bring other people in and take time to digest it. Now, your question, can what if do it? It depends what you mean by what if. In economics, what if is defined as changing one variable, a very little bit, keeping everything else constant. Scenario planning says the opposite. Don't change one variable, change many variables, yank them away from their current levels, and now see what new equilibrium that configuration of economic and social and technological outcomes may tend toward. And then the further caveat is it won't stay in equilibrium very long because there will be additional shocks. If the if is an interesting narrative, an interesting scenario about the future that is more comprehensive, great. Is the if is a symptom, like oil prices are going to, you know, shoot up by 30% next year, then this if is too shallow. Then the next question is, okay, if that happens, what else would happen?
The Science of Work is brought to you by Quantic, transforming the traditional MBA and EMBA with interactive platform that's built for modern students and future leaders. With a focus on innovation and strategy and mobile-first, network-driven approach, Quantic allows you to learn on your schedule and alongside leaders from the world's top companies. Visit quantic.edu/scienceofwork to learn more about the modern MBA. Speaking about strategy, at Conscious Works, we create meaningful, measurable strategies for proactive mental health and performance for your team. Make wellness make an impact every single day. Contact connect@consciousworks.com. So my question is, we tried to do a risk analysis. I know risk is different, but I would say it's more scenario planning with the definition that we're working with my company. I signed my first two employees 2 weeks before shutdown. We did not have global pandemic on our risk analysis and scenario.
You were not alone. You were not alone.
What's so frustrating to me, and like you just described some other situations where we thought it was a pretty clear cut idea, and then there's a whole social norm and social pressure that we had to give way to. So there's always going to be the thing that you didn't plan for. So how do you deal with that? So you're further along in the spectrum, if you will, going towards action or already acted, and then more come up.
I don't think it is optimal to plan for everything. It's going to be too costly, right? There will be low probability. I mean, should a company plan for the nuclear annihilation of the planet? No. So you first of all should think about things you can really do something about that are relevant. So you start with how is the external environment changing in ways that are actually relevant for us? Because if you go too broad, you know, you can't deal with everything. But let's say something like what happened to you, COVID, and suddenly shuts it down. At Wharton, we had, of course, a 9/11 event, and we had an executive program that was mostly face-to-face. And that really stopped the show, and people couldn't travel either. So they had already an inkling, an earlier situation where they had to really be prepared for the unthinkable. So when COVID happened, that whole Wharton Executive Education Center still was not totally ready to go virtual, but they had a huge jump on it because they went through 9/11. So maybe history doesn't repeat itself, but it surely rhymes. If you go back, you get a flavor of where your vulnerabilities really lie.
Yeah. So if you are able to do that SWOT analysis and kind of look at what those weak points might be, or better term, vulnerability. So for example, with my business, travel and gathering was a huge part of what we did. And of course, both of those things shut down. So what does that mean? And being able to pivot and address that. And now forevermore, we'll be prepared for similar type situations.
But right? You could have gotten to that. Not in hindsight, it's easy to say, but suppose I'd asked you at the start of your company, paint for me a bad scenario for you, right? Where you're not making any money, et cetera. Wouldn't you have listed those things? Then if you would have said, well, my customers are not coming or I cannot go to them. Why is that? Could be, you know, pandemic, could be a bad economy that nobody can afford you.
It could be my illness. Everything I'm hearing from you is being able to ask the right question. Like you said, the art of conversation, how do you ask the right questions and arguably at the right time during this process to do it? And you had mentioned a book. Is it actually called The Art of Strategic Conversation?
Yeah, it's called Scenarios, The Art of Strategic Conversation. I'll send you the reference, but it is by a fellow named the Dutch guy, Gees van der Heijden, who was the head of that scenario planning group for a period of time, like Peter Schwartz, who wrote a great book as well about the art of the long view. There's about five or so classic books in the field, but these are two of them that sort of lay this out. The problem is that academics don't know what you're talking about when you say scenario. It doesn't fit our disciplinary. I took a long sabbatical. I was at the University of Chicago where I was just promoted to associate professor. And I went for 2 years to London to be in their corporate planning group. And the reason was I interviewed one of their top people in scenario planning. And after a while, he sort of looked at me. Pierre Wack was his name. He was really the founder of that. And he said, Paul, and he smiled a little bit. If you really want to understand what we do, you got to join us for 2 years. What he was really saying is, this is an art, not a science. So I did do it because I'd written some books on uncertainty and risk and figured, hey, how does it really work in the real world? So it was a good thing to do. And it really changed my own orientation towards strategy, because strategy is just, I did individual risk-taking groups and organizations, but not strategy so much long-term. And that really was prompted by Shell. And I tried to then codify more in a book, Profiting from Uncertainty, I wrote, what this is really about. But what was interesting, when I came back from my sabbatical and I talked with these economists or finance guys at Chicago, and they said, okay, Paul, so what is this scenario planning all about? All I could say is to the management science people, well, it's like decision trees, but it's not entirely that. And when I talked to, let's say, the organization behavior people, I would say, well, it's a social change process, but there's a lot more to it. And eventually I concluded it came out of practice. It has many of these facets, multifaceted interventions that get the job done. And it doesn't decompose well into the core disciplines that you find in MBA programs. And to this day, I mean, if you look at the term scenario planning in the scholarly literature, there's no good journals for it. It doesn't have a home because it is not a science. It is an art. So at that versatility, you talked about agility a moment ago, because that is one of the strategies you need in a world of uncertainty. To me, it is two things in particular: speed, quick reactions, but also versatility of the reaction. It's not doing the same thing that you should do faster, but it's also nimbleness, finding new ways, maybe never tried ways, to get out of a fix.
Absolutely.
And how do you develop that? Well, that's practice, right? The school of hard knocks, I think, has more to teach there than book smarts.
So this is one thing that I've learned changing. I went from medicine to business for my postdoc. And in both disciplines, you're seeing an element of exactly what you just described, that there's a theory and we use it all the time in academia. But when it comes into practice, it's about experiencing it, living through it, and being able to talk through it in that way. So from a decision-making uncertainty perspective, what would positions look like within companies? You talked about Shell and the group that was working there. What would be the title of that group? What does that look like? And how would you advance if this is something you're curious about?
Well, you're taking a very large company. It was one of the largest companies in the world at the time, right? I was in a function called group planning, and that is a group of maybe 50 to 80 people. And in the old days, before OPEC happened, it's really, really old days, it was a very predictable world. You could predict that GNP growth would continue at 6% a year. Oil demand was growing at 6-7% per year. And these were stable times. What scenario planning did for the first time is maybe an interesting example. And some people in that group presented to the board of directors in 1971, so a long time ago, a scenario that said the supply of oil will not be as abundant as we had assumed, because at the moment there's many oil producing countries, OPEC, and they just each individually maximized their take. And they said, but it could be, but it requires a political event that they become a unified cartel. And that can only happen if there is a war between Israel and Egypt and Syria. And if that happens, oil could quadruple. I mean, oil was below $1 a barrel. And this scenario was brilliant because it happened in 1973. In 1973, that war broke out. Saudi Arabia and the Minister of Finance, Yamani, led this, and they policed everyone. And if Libya was producing more oil than had been agreed to, they would punish them. So suddenly oil does quadruple. And then the people at Shell, the leaders, made a very important decision. They said, listen, we were told about this by our Shell planners. None of us believed it. So this is a good methodology. And that was not the only scenario. There were two or three others. And they said, from now on, we have to do this ourselves. The lesson I learned is that the first generation of scenarios done by planners at Shell was brilliant, but irrelevant. The second generation was done by the line executives, the people who spent the money and have the budgets. It was not as brilliant. It was not as far-reaching, and it wasn't sort of reconceptualizing the industry as much, but it was extremely relevant. It totally impacted where money went. I've done a lot of this as a consultant. I try to get out of the picture fairly quickly. I don't want them to view them as my scenarios. They should be their scenarios. They present them. They have to take ownership of it. And that's the gentle art of doing consulting. So we then focus on the softer issues. You cannot have this deep dialogue where you really talk about the important issues unless you have mutual trust and mutual respect. And if those things are already absent, and many of our clients were dysfunctional clients, right, this process becomes used as a pawn to settle some other scores, right? Then it derails.
That is vastly interesting. And I am so curious, without naming companies if you don't want to, have you seen this done really well in a company that you're like, this is a great example? And have you seen it go sideways? You just talked about like—
Oh yes, I've certainly seen it sideways. No, there are public examples. 3M tried to do scenario planning and it didn't work well. I'm not saying that it was a dysfunctional organization, but it didn't click with their culture. I'm Dutch originally, and in Western Europe, scenario planning has taken off. But let's say the German culture, which is a more precise culture, finds it a more difficult methodology. Sure. So there's cultural issues about what is your tolerance of towards uncertainty? What is your future orientation? If you look at these anthropological measures that talk about organizational cultures, you're really dealing with things like uncertainty avoidance and future orientation. And if uncertainty avoidance is high, it becomes very difficult to say that there's a lot we don't know about our environment. That's already an insulting proposition. I did some work in Venezuela before Hugo Chavez took over. There was a national oil company called PDVSA, and we were doing a scenario exercise for that group with the senior leaders. Some of the people in the group there were talking about that Venezuela was politically unstable, that there was much dissatisfaction with the current government, and that there may be a populist leader supported by Cuba of the Hugo Chavez type, who would be elected president, and that this would then lead to further nationalization of the oil company. Now, that was not allowed to be discussed because the president of PDVSA himself was running to become president of the country. So this is a direct example of where the politics, and similar one with Microsoft, we were asked to do a project for Microsoft on the future of computers and all of that, IT, in mainland China. And they said very explicitly up front, you cannot discuss Taiwan and Hong Kong. In public settings, we cannot touch these subjects. So they took the most important key uncertainties of the future for mainland China off the table. That was not a very good scenario planning project.
With COVID, this little global pandemic we've been having, how has your work changed, or how has the conversations within companies changed about scenario planning, or have they?
Yeah, they have, because people realize that this is, has been a game changer economically and socially and work habits and all of that. And it's a great example of an uncertainty, because even the scientists couldn't tell you, you know, to what extent there will be variants like the Delta variant. And we can't even answer questions about whether the current vaccines, the Alpha vaccines, will be reformulated to fit some of these variants. And to what extent, if we have an unvaccinated population in the world, which we will have for 3-4 years, if you just look at the world broadly, right? The third world is not going to get this all in the next year. So the scenarios have to range from more pandemics, more variants, and if they really become lethal, you know, that extreme, like a Spanish flu all over again, to that it is a background noise like the flu, and we all get an injection and a boost, you know, every year. In between there is a lot. It also highlights that doing scenario planning is not enough. The pandemic scenarios, there were plenty developed. There were simulations developed, right, in the health community about things like COVID, but still it wasn't acted upon. So there's a further problem that if you present interesting futures that could happen that really bound or characterize the uncertainties, if people don't have enough belief in it or participation in it or feel ownership for this or feel it's part of their job to not get tripped up by this, it won't go anywhere. And that's the tragedy. The old saying, you know, if we don't study history, you know, we're doomed to repeat it. You could almost reformulate that saying that if we do study history, even then we will fall prey to it again. Because people had studied pandemics, the health community had clearly laid out the epidemiologists. It's not a matter of if, it's not a matter of when. This will happen. That's the problem. We didn't have the details specifically about how it transmits, where it originates. Then the coordinated action needed among governments worldwide was not well prepared, and whether it was the WHO, the World Health Organization. So this was an extremely difficult problem for governments and for societies, and still hasn't been solved.
In your personal life, do you tend to do the scenario planning for yourself when you're making decisions or within your own business context?
Yes, I do. Personally, I do. I mean, I live in Florida now, and we're near the ocean. So I'm playing Russian roulette with hurricanes. Now, having just seen what happened in the Panhandle or in Louisiana, et cetera, if you have a category 4 or 5, it's game over, right? I mean, you have a devastated state. I do it in that sense. I discuss what would we do in that case. But we do scenario planning anyway, right? We all, humans are very good at projective thinking. Oh, what are we going to do this weekend? If there's a wedding, everybody gets involved in planning it. So it's a very natural thing to do. And we often do it in the form of telling stories or vicariously living through these futures, already enjoying, you know, planning the trip, etc. The only difference in scenario planning is it's more disciplined, it puts more structure on it, and it forces an assessment of how, whether our current strategies are resilient or robust enough, and if not, what is the process by which we make them more resilient? So there is more, quote, engineering around it, but also social engineering, not just quantitative sort of stuff.
It must be so hard to remove self from that, because I imagine what gets in a lot of people's way is this emotional reaction or where they see themselves in the scenario. Or, for example, with you living on the ocean, like that is taking a large risk. But I imagine what won out that battle is, I want to live on the ocean. So there's certainly a desire, want, need that's coming from an individual
yes.
that's being placed upon a scenario.
And then the government has public policies that if this were to be wiped out, there will be FEMA comes in and they will fund again. So in the Netherlands, you could never live this close to the ocean. I don't know how it is in Canada, but right. they would not allow this because it's the poor people or the average people pay for the rich people to be near the ocean. But the builders want it. The builders have voting power. And of yes. course, these mostly Republicans here have voting power. It's a trap of sorts. And it's in that sense, not fair. But the scenario has to include those considerations as well. Is this politically sustainable? So New Orleans, is this politically sustainable? They're underwater. It's like the Netherlands, you know, is two-thirds below seawater if we didn't have levees or dikes. New Orleans is very similar. Parts of Manhattan are similar. How long do you want to put up with that? Do you keep fighting the climate and the ocean, or do you at some point just say what the Netherlands has done? We had a terrible flood in 1951 that killed many people, and they invested enormously in just water management. And farmers were told, we'll buy your farm, get away from the river, the Rhine. And when it now happens, enormous fields will just flood. They play with the ocean. They don't fight it. That has not happened here. Here we've built seawalls. You have $20 million properties here that have no beach, just a seawall. And they still sell for those values because people can afford it. The insurance company will cover it, but that's changing. They don't want to continue to cover it. This is a great one for scenario planning. And I follow real estate prices, let's say in Miami. If you're not 15 feet above sea level, you already get discounted for your apartment, if it's a condo or whatever it might be. These condos have their garages usually at the bottom. All these cars will flood, you know, when there's a bad storm. The signs are unmistakable.
So get a boat. That's what I'm hearing.
Get a boat. Get snorkels. Get a snorkel.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of The Science of Work. I hope your eyes have been open to scenario planning and a way to look forward in what can seem like fog. This is something I've started to practice personally as well as professionally. A special thanks to Dr. Paul Shoemaker for the conversation on the topic and to my team behind the scenes who make this podcast possible with research and audio. For full transcripts, sources, and further information on Dr. Shoemaker's books, please visit our website at consciousworks.com. Remember, consciously design your day, strategically, or somebody else will.